The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
This is Extraordinary Lives, a podcast from Lad Bible where we speak to people with a unique story to tell. I'm Ben Powell Jones, and coming up in this episode...
A newspaper was about to be thrown away by my next-door neighbor who was convicted of multiple rapes. And on the front section of the text section was about Sir Alec Jeffries. And he had taken the blood samples of men from Leicester and identified Colin Pitchfork as the murderer of a woman in Leicestershire. Mm-hmm. For the first time in history, science was used to identify someone genetically. When I read that newspaper, I knew one thing. I was innocent and I could prove it.
A warning that this episode contains content which you may find distressing. Hello and welcome to this episode of Extraordinary Lives, the podcast from Lad Bible. I'm Ben Powell Jones, and joining us in the studio today is Nick Yaris. Nick, great to have you here.
Thank you, Ben.
Nick, for anyone who doesn't know who you are, could you give us a brief introduction to yourself?
Yes, sir. I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and at the age of 20, I was sentenced to die for the rape and murder of a woman I never met in my life. I then went on to spend the next 23 years of my life in solitary confinement on death row, awaiting to be executed. Thankfully, DNA testing proved me innocent in 2003, and I was released from custody in 2004.
Amazing, amazing introduction, and I'm really excited to hear all about your story. But let's go back to the beginning. You know, who were you as a kid? How did you grow up?
I grew up in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on the east coast of the United States. But unfortunately for me, at the age of 7, I had a traumatic experience where I was attacked by a man in my neighborhood and I was assaulted with a field stone and he left me with brain damage.
For what reason?
I don't know. I think it was just a sexual predator move that the man wanted to attack me. And in his frustration or fear, he hit me in the head with a field stone. I was hit in the frontal lobe of my head and it caused aphasia. And it also restricted my optic nerve. So I had to wear corrective lenses on my eyes. I didn't know about aphasia. And aphasia can be identified as simply as someone who stutters. Because their brain is working too fast for their vernacular system to catch up and speak. Mine was different in that every time that I got stressed out, I would become monosighted and only be able to see out of my right eye, and I wouldn't be able to function in an argument. I kept shutting down in frustration. And so I had a lot of outburst and anger as a child. Mm.
So you said this was the beginning of you going off the rails, so to speak. So what happened there? What was the progression of that?
I kept trying to evade the fear. So initially I began drinking alcohol, and it was one of those things where the first time I got intoxicated on alcohol, I no longer felt afraid. I wasn't afraid of that being seen by my attacker in the neighborhood or being in the alley alone and have him terrorize me again and again. And I think that feeling of wanting to not be afraid is what drove me to become an alcoholic and then a drug addict.
So it was, you were using them as an escape, basically.
Yeah, a numbing sensation, an escape, a fear alleviator. Those are the real reasons a lot of people will start drinking and doing drugs, because they're filled with a fear or they're filled with anger and they want to be done with it. And the easiest way that a lot of young people will find is through intoxications.
And what age was this? That this was, because you said that, did you say at the age of 7 you were hit with this stone?
Yeah, so about the age of 10, 11, and 12, I started drinking.
Wow.
By the time I was 14, I was fully involved with drugs. By the time I was 17 years old, I was injecting methamphetamine into my veins.
Wow. And did you have a safety net, like a family around you or friends or anything like that? Or had you removed yourself from them?
I was so chaotically violent, no one could care about me. I literally hated myself. And at the age of 17 or 18, I had no qualms about being violent, disrespectful. I hated myself. Why would I care about anyone or what they would say to me?
Mm. And am I right in thinking that you began to have problems with the law, runnings with the law?
Exactly what happens when most people are addicted to narcotics or alcohol. I ran afoul of the police because I became a petty thief to try and keep up with my addictions. And unfortunately, this is what unraveled my life. I was a car thief in the Philadelphia area. Mm. On December 4th, 1981, at the age of 20, I stole an automobile and I got chased by the Philadelphia police. And they gave me a terrible beating. About 3 weeks after that, I started using drugs again, really badly. And I went out one night in a stolen car again, and I got stopped in the city of Chester, Pennsylvania. The police officer who pulled me over this time didn't have to chase me because I was terrified of running. I had just received a beating for doing that. The officer got angry at me because I wouldn't get out of my car, and he pulled me out of the car and began fighting with me. I knocked the club away from him after pushing his hands away from my throat, and he pulled his gun out. When he did, I put both hands on the gun, and unfortunately, it went off at that time.
Oh my God. Where was it pointed when it went?
Down at the ground.
Right, that must have been terrifying.
Well, it really escalated from there because I started to shout, okay, repeatedly, as if that was my surrender. Mm. He put the gun under my chin, put me in the back seat of the automobile, and then composed himself for at least a minute while he thought about what he was going to do next. He grabbed the radio from the car's dash and very pointedly pretended like the attack was still going on by shouting excitedly, officer assist, police officer assist, shots fired, help, help, help.
My God.
So all of the ensuing officers that came to the scene thought he was under attack. They drug me out of the car. They beat me. They put me in a paddy wagon, it's called, and they took me to jail and charged me with the attempted murder and kidnapping of a police officer.
Why do you think he did that?
He was angry at me. Mm-hmm. See, the officer Benjamin Wright, who would later be arrested for being a criminal himself, had never failed to overpower somebody in his life. For the first time ever, I overpowered him by resisting him. And I think that really struck his ego. So he said to the ensuing officers who arrived, I took his gun off him, that I actually jumped out of my car, ran back to him, took his gun off him, and was trying to blow his brains out with his own gun when he heroically overpowered me. Right. And took the gun back.
So he literally flipped the story of what happened?
On the spot.
Yeah, wow.
I was so devastated by this lie. As I stood next to my public defender, he told me I was going to spend the rest of my life in jail.
Did you try to explain what had happened at the time when the other police arrived? Or did you just, you know, what were you saying when they arrived and he was started to say to them, he took the gun off me, etc.?
I didn't get a chance to speak. They beat me.
Right.
When one of your fellow officers has almost been killed, it's not pleasant. Mm. And in America, they were jacked up at this time with anger. I went into the prison and I capitulated. I fell apart. I admit this. I did one of the worst things in my life. I laid there in my own misery, going through a drug withdrawal without any treatment. And I made up a story out of a newspaper that was in my cell, trying to use a lie to get out of the lie that was put on me.
How would that have helped?
In America, you can barter your way out of criminal charges if you know something bigger than what you've been arrested for.
Right. So if you help them solve a bigger crime, then your charges will be lessened or thrown out.
Yes.
Right.
So in my stupid 20-year-old drug addict mind, I thought I would play a game on the police, hoping to get released enough so that I could run away. They told me initially that they were going to release me on my own recognizance after they spoke to my arresting officer and he admitted that he was going to reduce the charges and I would be charged with resisting arrest and be taken to Philadelphia for the auto theft charges. In other words, initially my ploy worked.
Hmm. because you'd said that you... Could you talk us through that? What was the other crime that you'd said that you knew something about or you'd help them solve?
The only thing in my cell when I first was arrested was a newspaper from Delaware County. On the front page was the mystery of a missing and then abducted and murdered woman who was found in the area, and the police were baffled as to who did this crime. Mm-hmm. I picked out a friend who one time had robbed me and hurt me, and I thought was dead at the time, to blame it on. I told the police that this person who I thought was dead did the crime and told me about it, and hoped that I would be able to trick the police with this stupid lie. Initially, they told me they believed me, and they went out and tried to solve the crime based on my words in this. Then they came back to me and they said, the reason I made up a lie about someone else is I was trying to confess and it was me who committed this murder, and they wouldn't take no for an answer.
Wow. So you've gone from being the person who's basically invented you said you could help them solve the crime of the mystery of the murder of the lady. They've gone out and then come back and said, actually, what you said wasn't true. You must have done it.
Exactly.
That's a leap in logic on their part as well, though.
Yeah, but that's because this was one of those crimes where they needed to have an assurance to the community of an arrest.
Right.
The detective was really insulted by what I tried to do to him. I kept telling him, look, you talked to the officer. He said he was going to reduce my charges. Surely that's proof that I didn't try to murder him. And he said, oh, that doesn't matter anymore. Because you killed this woman, we know you're trying to come forward, that you're blaming it on a friend that you thought was dead because you knew we would come back and find out the truth. And we know you want to tell us why you killed her. And I was like, no, I didn't do it. So they said, you had a breakup with your girlfriend. And they started mocking me about why she would leave me. And I got angry at them and started shouting at them. And this is how weird it was. They never said that I confessed to anybody. They put a prisoner in the cell next to me who had been convicted of robbing the prosecutor's home. He said that I confessed to him after being in the cell next to him for one night.
So that was the evidence.
So he could get out of his charges. They used him against me.
And do you think they knew he was lying?
Of course they did.
So they
put him in the cell next to me for one night, Ben.
But so therefore they... So do you think they thought you'd committed the crime, or do you think that they didn't care who'd committed the crime?
I think that they believed that I committed the crime.
Right, okay. So they were using any means necessary to solve the crime, and that included a fake witness.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
So I'm now charged with the attempted murder of a police officer and the rape and murder of a woman I never met. Unfortunately for me, the police also told the local Pagan's motorcycle gang that I was an informant. So for the first week of my incarceration, after I was released from the security holding cell, I was attacked every day. I had a man try to put my eye out with a sharpened broomstick. I had urine and feces thrown in my face and in my cell. I had to stand for hours with my mattress against my door so that men couldn't throw things on me. And then when I got the door open for my shower time, I would come out and attack anybody in front of me, whether they did anything to me or not. I was trying to stop the savagery that was being aimed at me. After a week of that, I hung myself in my cell, and a prison guard came in and cut me down and told me I wasn't allowed to cheat the state of Pennsylvania out of my punishment.
My God. Why was it true that you were an informant?
No.
Why would they do that?
Because they were putting pressure on me to try and make me come back to them again to confess.
Wow. Okay. And at that point, after a week, you decided enough was enough and you wanted out, but they wouldn't allow you to do that.
And then I had a visit with my mother in the hospital in the county jail, in which inmates were making rude comments about her. And she made me promise, no matter what I went through, never do that. She told me that I was a gift of her life, and I had no right to destroy that gift no matter what it was done to me. So literally at the age of 20, I promised my mother I would never kill myself.
Wow. So at this point, you're in prison and you know that you've just got to go through whatever's thrown at you to get to the sentencing for the crimes that they're saying you'd committed.
But the crazy thing is, God had a plan. I was originally taken to trial for the attempted murder of the police officer. Mm-hmm. My word against him, it should have been a slam dunk. The jury found me not guilty after 20 minutes of deliberation after hearing both sides of the story.
Wow.
You see, the police officer made up this big story about the attack that I had committed upon him, and he used a photograph of his hand as evidence that I took the gun off of him. But he told this elaborate story of how I punched him in his face, hit him with his own pistol, breaking his eyeglasses. My lawyer simply said, if you were going to take a photograph of the evidence of someone assaulting you, surely you would photograph your face. Mm. In that moment, the jury realized he was lying. So they found me not guilty, and it was one of the worst events because the prosecutor became so incensed by losing that trial, he threw the case file against the wall and promised me I would never leave the county alive. He then, on his own, took over the prosecution of the homicide case of this woman that I never met and demanded the death penalty.
Wow. Okay, and you're 20 at this point.
20 years old.
And you've been told that you're going to be up for the death penalty. How did that feel?
I was angry because I saw what they were doing. They weren't going to let me have a fair trial the next time. Because they gave me a fair trial and a jury found me not guilty, they weren't going to risk this again. I knew that. So in June of 1982, I had just turned 21 years old. A jury was shown a series of photographs, one of which was a photograph of these two children who were walking in the snow and they found the victim, whose name was Linda Mae Craig. The boys kicked the snow away from what they thought was a mannequin to see if it was a male mannequin or a female mannequin, only to discover Mrs. Craig was laying there. The children's footprints were black. It was a black and white photograph. And then as they ran away from the figure, it looked like the angel's wings spread out. They showed that jury that photograph, and the jury couldn't look at me again. Mm-hmm. I knew what was going to happen. His Honor told the jury I was only going to be given a 3-day trial. And this was the third day. After they did that, and the jury put their heads down and they couldn't look at me no more, a bolt of lightning struck the courthouse and knocked all the power out. You can't make this up. I was taken out of the room as if I had something to do with this moment, like I was trying to escape or something. They hustled me out of the courtroom with guns drawn and put me in this big room on top of the courthouse. There is in that moment, I stood there and I heard God say to me, go and look them in the eye. So, when they got themselves back together and they took me back in the courtroom, the judge couldn't look at me while he was about to sentence me to death. So I kept asking him, how dare you not have the courage to look me in the eye and you're about to sentence me to die? Aren't you ashamed of that? And when he raised his head, he said, are you finished? I said, no, sir, you can go to hell. But all they said in the newspaper was defiant murderer tells judge go to hell. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the whole story. The jury sentenced me to death. I was placed in the custody of Huntington State Prison, the only prison condemned by the United Nations for its active practices of torture. And I entered a building in which the average rate of survival was only 5 years.
5 years? And what were the causes of death in there?
Suicide, cancers, mental deterioration so you just lost it. And then a lot of men just killed each other or they were killed by staff or themselves.
Wow. Were you aware of this going in there?
Initially, Pennsylvania didn't have a death row, so they put us in the punishment unit where they broke men. My first 2 years in my cell, I wasn't allowed to speak. In my cell.
2 years? You weren't allowed to just make any noise?
I sung happy birthday to myself on my 22nd birthday and I got a beating for it.
What?
Four men come into your cell with riot gear. They hold you down while a nurse who's wearing a riot helmet and a flak vest has a needle full of Thorazine, and she would run in and stab you in the buttocks with this needle, and then you would lose a week of your life. If you broke the rules again, they dragged you out of your cell and they put you in a glass bubble, a brick cell made out of glass bricks. And every 15 minutes, they did what was called a head count and woke you up and made you stand on your feet and acknowledge them for a week.
So these were these practices that you're describing, were they legal, or would these be classed as torture and the guards and the staff going off the rules?
This was actually protocol in the prison. That's why it was condemned by the United Nations. They literally tortured me like they tortured everyone else.
And was that as soon as you got in there at 21 years old, was that your experience immediately? You were put in a cell and told you're not allowed to speak anymore. You know, what was the initial moving in there at such a young age? How did it feel and what did it look like?
When I arrived at the prison at the age of 21, all of the other prisoners were taken off of the bus, and then four men came onto the bus with riot gear. They always had to hide their faces. They drugged me off the bus and they lined me up against the wall, and then a lieutenant walked up to me and explained me the following. You're dead. Dead men do not speak in my unit. Do you understand me? Everyone that knew you and anyone that you loved is now dead to you. If you open your mouth in this unit, I will break your face. I said, yes, sir. I broke the rules. So he turned to his officers and he said, 30 seconds. And they beat me with oak sticks for 30 seconds. Then I was drugged into the unit and thrown into my first cell, cell number 447. The nurse then came up to me and by rote asked me if I could understand how to fill out a DC-136 medical form, should I need to see a member of the staff for any medical issues?
Wow. So that's your first experience.
It was my first day on death row.
Hey, this is Ben Powell Jones. We're just taking a brief break so I can tell you about one of our sponsors, a brand new six-part podcast from Message Heard and Podimo. Who Robs a Banksy follows journalist Jake Warren as he sets out to explore the stranger-than-fiction tale of the man who kidnapped a Banksy statue from the middle of central London in broad daylight and held it to ransom. The act would lead to an almost 20-year war of bad blood, relations, and legal battles that are still being waged today, and it all comes down to one man and one vendetta. But it doesn't end there. The story will take us on a journey through UK's most subversive subcultures, from art heists and art terrorists to 80s football hooliganism and the 90s illegal rave scene, even fetish parties. And throughout it all, Jake will be trying to get a hold of the most elusive and famed anonymous artist in the world. In the new six-part series, host Jake Warren speaks to Tiger King of the art scene, Andy Link, and those closest to Banksy himself, exposing their two-decade-long feud and attempting to track down the world's most elusive anonymous artist. Who Robs a Banksy is available now wherever you get podcasts. To hear the whole series ad-free, subscribe to Podimo UK on Apple Podcasts. Now back to our episode.
And what are you, when you're looking around, can you describe death row to us? Are there other prisoners around you? Can you see other prisoners? Can you communicate with other prisoners? I know you've been told that you're not allowed to speak to them, but what does it look like from your cell?
I was put in a 6x10 foot cell and I didn't get to see anyone for weeks because I was too terrified to come out of my cell and find out about the next beating stage. The next time I came out, I was stripped naked and taken to the showers, six at a time, with 12 officers escorting two on one. Then they put you in this giant building room and they turn on these spigots of water above your head. You have 3 minutes to shower. You get water on your body, you get soap on your body as best you can and hope nobody attacks you.
And was that something that was possible? Did people attack each other in the showers?
Of course. That was the most dangerous room in the jail, man.
For what reason?
Because you can get to somebody. I watched a kid get stabbed to death with a pork chop bone that was sharpened.
Is this because of arguments between people, or was it just violence for the sake of violence?
I often ask myself. It just seemed like hate was all around me, so intense. It didn't take much for people to kill themselves or kill someone else. My first week there, I saw someone kill themselves. It's horrible. But occasionally a man couldn't take it no more. He would just jump off the top tier and kill himself with handcuffs on.
What, just over the balcony and falling all the way down to the floor at the bottom?
Yep, head first.
Wow, and you saw that in your first week?
Yeah, I thought it was a mattress being thrown away. Put a plastic mattress we were forced to sleep on. It hit the ground so hard, I thought it was a plastic mattress. So I stood up and I looked out of my cell window, and there was a young black kid, couldn't have been more than 2 years older than me, laying there twitching on the ground.
Oh, God. I mean, that must have had a huge effect on you at your age, looking down on that. You know, what was it like mentally to know that there's no hope of release anymore?
I was so angry at the beginning, I used to beat my head on the wall. I felt like if I stayed angry, I could fight. It was the stupidest thing in the world. You can't last with anger. But I was afraid and I didn't know what else to do, so I just constantly beat my head against the wall all day long till my head bleed. And then an officer took me out of the cell, and he went past one of the cells in which a man killed himself, and he made me go in the cell and take some books out of there that weren't urine stained or damaged from blood and stuff. So I picked through this pile of books in a man's cell that had already killed himself, and I took the books back to my cell. I began my whole education that way.
Why did the officer do that? Just to give you some books?
I think he took pity on me.
Yeah.
I was only a kid. I was the second youngest person in Pennsylvania's history to be sentenced to die at that time.
And how many people were on death row at the point you were there?
When I first went there, there was only 27 men.
Right.
In less than 5 years, there was 245.
Wow. Was that because they were ramping up the amount of sentences given for...
The crack epidemic sent America crazy.
Mm.
President Reagan got shot by a mentally ill person by the name of John W. Hinckley. The United States government emptied out its mental institutions right at the epicenter of the crack epidemic. And everyone watched as America went from 1 million incarcerated human beings to 3 million.
Hmm. And with the other people on death row, did you ever communicate with them? Like, were you able to speak with them and them with you, or were you just completely yourself alone in your cell?
I could talk to someone in the exercise cages outside.
Hmm.
I was given initially 15 minutes of exercise every other day. So they would let you out of your cell and you would run around in this courtyard as much as you were able to for 15 minutes, or as long as the officer could take to smoke 2 cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put you back in your cell. Occasionally, they would let another prisoner out with you so that the two of you could run together. Then they changed that up and built these cages, exercise cages, 10 foot wide and 20 foot long. And they used to stick you in there. So I would be locked up 23 hours a day for 8,057 days.
So what did you do every day? What did you do in your cell?
Initially, I had to learn to fight for myself because my lawyer didn't believe in me and he mocked me. My first appellate attorney told me he knew I was crazy and guilty, but he was going to file my appeal anyway out of pity.
And is this a state-appointed attorney? Yeah. So obviously it doesn't give you much hope. And how did that go, that appeal?
I was actually granted a new hearing for a new trial.
Mm-hmm.
But this is crazy. That's how I ended up escaping from death row. I was being transported to court for that new hearing. See, I was convicted of the abduction and kidnapping of a woman in the state of Delaware,
mm-hmm.
not in the state of Pennsylvania. And yet those factors were used as aggravating factors to send me to death row, which is illegal. So at nothing else, I had to have a new trial and a new hearing. I'm on my way to court on February 15th, 1985.
Sorry to interrupt you. So how long at this point when you're being given a new trial, how long have you been in death row at this point?
3.5 years.
Right. So a long time, 3.5 years. And now you're being transferred to a new place for a retrial.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I was arrested in 1981. In 1985, I was being taken to court. We stopped to use the restroom in the coldest night of the year, and I'm wearing eyeglasses. I get out of the car, my eyeglasses fog up as I run into a cubicle about 100 yards from the car where it's parked. I go into the cubicle, and I'm urinating, and my eyeglasses fog up again because I'm breathing. Mm-hmm. Anyone that wears eyeglasses can appreciate what happens next. As I'm exiting the building to go back to the patrol car to go to court, the officer standing there holding the door for me had to go to the toilet so bad, he let me go back by myself. As I'm jogging in the snow, in the dark, back to the officer with fogged up eyeglasses, I don't see his reaction. He only turned around after smoking a cigarette and saw me running at him. He pulls his gun out, and all I see is his arm come forward, and he blasts a shot at me.
Why?
He thought I overpowered his partner.
Oh.
His partner should have never left me alone after standing by the door. He didn't communicate to his partner. Nick's coming back by himself. He went in the toilet.
Oh, my God.
And because of this one incident, the officer starts shooting at me, thinking I overpowered his partner, tries to blow my head off. I turn around and run. He fired another shot. I hit the ground. I then jumped up, and I ran in a circle, and I ended up hiding behind their patrol car by about 50 yards, laying there watching them screaming at each other about what had happened. I'm terrified. I'm 24 years old. I haven't killed anybody. Now I've just been shot at for escaping from death row. I can't trust them. I can't trust anyone. I was laying there on my stomach, vomiting from the exertion and the shock of all this happening. When I took my eyeglasses off, I took the handcuffs off my hands using my eyeglasses. And then I got up on my knees and I crawled behind a police station. And I hid there. I didn't know what to do. So I stayed there for almost 2 hours, and then I was freezing so poorly, I had to get out of there. When I left that area, someone saw me in a helicopter, began chasing me. So for 5 hours of my life, I got chased so hard by a helicopter. It was unbelievable because the blades were right down on me. At one point, I was running towards this 10-foot fence, and I didn't know what I was going to do. But the fence had been pushed back by the snow plows who had been moving the snow previous to that night. And as I ran up towards it, just like magic, I stumbled, I fell, I hit my belly, I slid, and I went under the fence, and I slalomed down about 60 yards down the embankment of a train tracks. The helicopter had been right over my head. The snow flying up over me as I fell and slid down made him lose sight of me. As I slid and slalomed down the hill, I landed perfectly. I didn't even get cut. My face and everything was leading the way. I stood up like the abominable snowman, shook off the snow, and began walking down the train tracks while the helicopter circled back overhead. I walked for 5 miles to Fraser, Pennsylvania, and I found the only car in the parking lot was a 65 green Mustang, and I drove that to New York City and got out of there.
Oh, my God. That's incredible.
So was the bolt of lightning that hit the courthouse. I'm telling you, this is crazy what's going on with my life.
So when you say you found a car, did you hotwire it or were the keys in it?
Literally, a 1965 Mustang had looked like a coin slot for the key fob. Mm-hmm. I literally turned it by hand. It was so old and so used, I didn't need keys to start it.
You just turned like the cylinder by hand?
Yeah, and I put my foot on the clutch, started the car. It was a 3-speed, and then I started driving away.
My God. So at this point, I mean, you've escaped, but you weren't actually trying to escape. It almost sort of happened by accident. So what's going through your head?
They're going to kill me.
So you're not thinking, I need to hand myself in. You're thinking, I need to get away from
it. I'm thinking, I got a new trial being ordered for me by the Supreme Court, and they're afraid I'm going to get to be able to prove my innocence, so they're setting me up to kill me. Mm. That's my mindset. Why would dude blast at me? See, I didn't know what happened about the officers at the time of the cubicle when I'm urinating. Mm-hmm. That was all testimony later on at my escape trial, mm-hmm. when they explained to the court why they did what they did. All of this is verified. It's crazy. So I'm on the run, and now I have all these scratches all over me. I'm in New York City, and I look like a horror show. I saw all these televisions with my mother on the news, and I thought, they're going to kill me. It's crazy. I saw in the window of a shop, it was two gay men standing there together in a loving pose, like, and it was a hair salon. And in an instant, I don't even know why I did it to this day. I burst in the door and I pretended I was being attacked by my boyfriend. And I said, look, you got to help me. He's going to kill me. Look what he's done to me. They looked at me and all these scratches and cuts, and they said, sit down. In the next 3 hours, these two men put makeup on me. They dyed my hair. They permed it. And they got a friend of theirs to come over, who was an optometrist, and give me a pair of eyeglasses.
Wow.
In 3 hours, I walked out of that shop completely unidentifiable to the police.
God, so they did that just to help you out. They would just do it out of the goodness of their heart for someone that they thought was in trouble.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Because I was so young,
yeah.
They really did think that my boyfriend was beating me and hurting me, and that I could escape him and his terrible clutches upon me if they changed my appearance.
So how long were you on the run for?
25 days, and then I turned myself in.
Wow. I mean, what's it like being on the run?
Oh, no, Ben, you don't ever want to know that. Every moment, you're just waiting to get shot in the head.
Mm.
I would be walking down the street and freak out. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Like, just... I had a crazy experience where I met a girl in Florida. We hooked up one night, and then she invited me back to her house the next evening. And I thought I was going there to pick her up for a date. Her mom invited me in, and I ended up having dinner in these people's house with their family while being on escape. It was so surreal. Part of me wanted to be normal, and I was so polite and sweet at dinner. When the police contacted that family and told them later on who I was, her mother said, well, I can't believe this is true about him, because to this date, he's still the most polite, kind person my daughter ever brought home.
Mm.
Crazy.
And were you sleeping rough at that point?
I had stolen that a man's coat, and I took some... jewelry and stuff from his home. I flew to his house from New York City thinking he would still be there. So I stole from him, and I had enough money to get hotel rooms. So I was bouncing from hotel to hotel, trying to get a birth certificate to get a passport to leave the country.
Mm.
So I drove all over the state of Florida back and forth trying to do this before I realized it was just total folly and I had to go back.
Mm. Okay. So you decided to go back because there was no hope, essentially. There was no way out. Is that what you thought?
I knew I wasn't as clever as I thought I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't outwit the whole law enforcement society.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go back. I called my father from Florida, and I asked him to tell the FBI where I was. So the state authorities in Florida arrested me, put me on death row next to Ted Bundy for 8 months before they sent me back home.
Wow. So did you meet Ted Bundy?
Yeah, he spit on me.
Why did he do that?
He tried to sell me hope. And I told him, I don't get off on killing little children and thinking about my bad mommy, and he can go fuck himself.
Wow. He tried to sell you hope? In what sense?
He was a well-known jailhouse lawyer.
Right.
He signed me up for the law library with him. Teddy knew about me from being introduced to the jail, and he used to live in Philadelphia, so he was going to meet me.
Mm. And was he famous at that point? Did you know who he was?
I knew who he was, and I had no respect for him.
Yeah.
See, and the misnomer is death row prisoners get along with serial killers.
Mm.
People who go out and butcher women and children do not get a warm reception in prison.
Mm.
Plus, at the fact, at that time, he was boasting about getting one of his visitors pregnant, so he had gotten all the death row prisoners' visitation taken off them. Everybody wanted to kill him.
Right, okay. Okay, so you got put there for 8 months, did you say? And that was while they waited to move you back...
to Pennsylvania.
To Pennsylvania. And this escape had happened because you were going for a retrial. So was the retrial then cancelled or did that go through? What was the results there?
I ruined all my appeals. The state of Florida put 35 years onto my sentence. And at the time that I was returned to Pennsylvania in 1986, I had 105 years of total sentences plus the death penalty, and I wasn't expected to live.
Wow. Okay. And at this point, so earlier you said that you were legally allowed a retrial because they tried you in the wrong place. Was that still possible or was that now just off the table?
Everything was off the table.
Okay. Right. Okay. That must have been quite hard to think about in the sense that there was no way out, right?
No. I enrolled in university and I began reading all the world's religions.
Why did you do that?
I don't know. I wanted to have respect for everyone's beliefs. And the crazy thing is, over the next couple of years, while I read all of the world's religions, when I finally got to the last one of reading Sanskrit, I found out about DNA testing. A newspaper was about to be thrown away by my next door neighbor who was convicted of multiple rapes. And on the front section of the text section was about Sir Alec Jeffries. At that time, he was just Dr. Alec Jeffries from Leicestershire University. And he had taken the blood samples of men from Leicester and identified Colin Pitchfork as the murderer of a woman in Leicestershire. Mm-hmm. For the first time in history, science was used to identify someone genetically. When I read that newspaper, I knew one thing. I was innocent and I could prove it.
That must have been a big moment for you to read that. Because prior to that, presumably, all evidence had to be based on things people were willing to say they'd seen or heard or, you know, things that were caught on camera, maybe. Whereas now there was a way of proving definitively that something had happened or somebody was somewhere. That must have been huge for you.
Unfortunately and fortunately for me, the real killer had B-positive blood typing. All we had in the early 80s was serology of blood typing to tell that you were part of a group and therefore possible as a killer. You get it?
Mm-hmm.
15% of the white male population, B positive. When I found out about DNA, I knew it wasn't just a numbers game. This was identifiable. So I became the very first man in America to seek DNA testing in February of 1988.
Okay. So you've gone back to death row, presumably. How were the guards treating you when you went back after the escape and everything like that? Was it the same or were they worse? Or did, you know, how was that? Because the reason I'm asking is you're leading up to now appealing again. And I'm wondering how that impacted on their view of you and their treatment of you.
On my first year back from escape, they used to strap me up with 50,000 volts of electricity if I wanted to come out of my cell.
What do you mean?
They put a belly band on me with a high intensity shocker over both kidneys. And if I went out of my cell because I had escaped and embarrassed them, I had to wear this belt called a stun belt. And I had to watch while I exercised wearing this as the two officers played catch with it.
Just as a mind game thing? Wow. Wow, the thought of people being in control of, you know, your life and the pain and suffering like that, who had little respect for you, that must have been horrendous.
Yeah, but it taught me love. being tortured actually taught me how to have compassion for my attacker. It taught me how to love other human beings.
How does that work?
When you're faced with evil, you have two choices: join in or use love. The only way you can hold on from being tortured is to figure out your own value system. Do you value your own life? Do you value who you are? If so, you won't be hateful.
It's interesting you say that, because earlier you said, when you were I asked you what feelings you were feeling, you said anger, a lot of anger when you were in death row. And then just before, you said you started reading about religions because you wanted to respect everybody's opinions. So there'd obviously been some sort of transition somewhere along the way from anger to what you're describing now. Was there a catalyst for that, or was it just something that began to happen?
I got tired of being inhuman. I wanted to find out if God could truly be real. Why would you strike the courthouse with a bolt of lightning on the day that they found me guilty if you weren't real? I kept asking. And I found out this crazy thing. I have a unique ability to love. Love for my torturer. Love for the inmate who tried to cut my throat. Love for the people who hated me. And if I could hold on to my love, I could hold on to my humanity. That's all it meant to me.
And was that something you taught yourself? Do you think anybody has that? Or do you think it's something that was just within you?
Everyone's born that way, Ben. No one wants to be evil. Someone else has driven them to their anger to be that. We're all born good. We learn hatred and anger from others. I didn't like that about myself. And I was so embarrassed that I couldn't speak that I made up my mind. The whole reason I began to develop the ability to speak beautifully wasn't so that I could get out of jail and talk to anyone. I had 2.5 minutes to speak about my life before they executed me by strapping me into an electric chair and pulling the f***ing switch.
So that's what they give you on death row. They give you 2.5 minutes to say something. Is that what you're saying?
And that's my moment. I didn't want to be embarrassed anymore. I thought, okay, I ruined my appeals. I've screwed up. They're going to kill me. The only hope I have, I want to learn how to overcome my speech impediment. I want to learn how to articulate words so powerful and beautiful that when they take my life for something I didn't do, the last thing I hear is the beautiful voice of me telling them how much I love them and forgive them for what they did to me.
Wow. It's amazing.
It's what made me the finest speaker in the world. I learned that every day of our lives is a deaf speech, if you think about it. Each one of us are living under a death sentence. We don't know when it will come. Very rarely you'll know the end. So every day of your life, your duty is to not only tell others who you are in fairness and eloquence, but maybe, just maybe, you'll be the last voice that they hear that day. Don't you want it to be beautiful?
This is Ben Powell Jones. We're just going to take a break from today's episode to talk about one of our sponsors, BetterHelp. This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. How much time do you spend on yourself in an average week? So easy to get caught up in what everyone else needs from you and never take a moment to think about what you need from yourself. But when we spend all of our time giving, it can leave us feeling stretched thin and burned out. Therapy can give you the tools to find more balance in your life so you can keep supporting others without leaving yourself behind. Therapy is something I've used several times in my own life. I think sometimes we think it has to be for huge events or massive changes, but I like to just use it every couple of months or a couple of times a year, check in on myself. If anything's feeling like a struggle, book a few sessions, top myself back up. Visit betterhelp.com/minuteswith today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/minuteswith. Now back to the episode.
I want to go back a little bit. When you were talking just then, you were talking about the people that you found a way to love. One of them you said was the inmate who tried to slit your throat. Where did that come from?
I had a bounty on me in prison. Back in the 80s, if you killed someone who had a high-profile case, people would put money on your books.
And who would do that? Who would pay the bounty?
Friends and family of the victims.
Oh, I see, right. And they'd communicate that to people in prison who then...
Once it's known.
Wow, okay. So, and that's what happened? Somebody tried to...
Oh, I had a lot of attacks.
Wow.
I've had multiple attacks staged so that the first attack was the fake out. And then the other attack happened in the hospital waiting for me.
Wow.
I've been stabbed so deeply with a bed slat, a metal bed slat, that I had to go ahead and headbutt my attacker over and over while holding the knife inside of my belly. If you let it out, they're going to hit you again and again with it. So I literally grabbed his arm, held it inside of my stomach while I headbutted him over and over.
And that being a possibility of daily life must have taken a huge toll.
I changed the game. I wasn't going to be that way anymore. Ben, as I sit before you, they put me in the cage to fight against other men that I didn't have any angst against, and I had to beat them to a pulp.
I've heard you say this before, and it's the most unbelievable account of something that just sounds so inhumane. Can you tell us about that?
Gladiator.
Yeah.
There were so many white officers beating on black inmates that after the crack epidemic, when they hired large numbers of black officers to come up into the mountains to work there, they couldn't tolerate this. So in a crazy scheme, they came up with Gladiator School to level the playing field. Two black officers would come out, pick up a white guy, march him out to the unit, put him in the cage, and wait for two white officers to go pick out a black guy. And then they would bet on us or laugh at us and taunt us.
And they'd just say to you, you have to fight.
I beat a boy named Billy Tilly so bad I broke his hip. It still bothers me. Me and Billy were friends.
And what would happen if you refused?
Both of you get beat with the sticks.
Is this something that's ever been, like, officially, like, prosecuted or...
Prosecuted?
Yeah, I mean, it just sounds horrendous.
It's not horrendous, it's real. Yeah. It's what they did to us.
So they'd get two guys, put them in a cage and say, right, fight each other till we tell you to stop, otherwise we're going to come in there and beat
you. Your paperwork's already filled out. If you refuse, you're going to go out in a body bag.
And when would they let the fight stop? What was the point?
Somebody's got to go down.
Yeah.
I stomped a lot of people. I had a fight with one guy who was so big, I thought I was going to get overwhelmed. Luckily, I broke his ankle and did him. But I promised my mother I was coming home, so I don't care who they put me in a cage with. I was going to whoop his ass. Mm.
And how many of those gladiator sessions do you think you went through in total?
Probably about 50.
God. And do you think they'd have been worried that it could have gone too far? Like, surely if someone had been actually killed, that would have been something that was looked into, or?
No.
Man.
I know it's crazy for the average world, but you have to understand, this is what happened and caused the Princeton experiment. This is real. When people in power have an abusive ability to hurt others, they choose that. And yeah, I had to learn all these mixed martial arts. I'm probably one of the most dangerous persons sitting before you, and I can kill you as you sit there. Or badly maim you if I needed to. I don't like that side that they developed for me. But I had to. I had no choice. They were putting me in there against men who butchered someone and ground them up into meatballs and fed them to her parents. They were putting me in a cage against people who put people into a pit and tortured them and tortured them and tortured them. They were putting me in a cage against monsters.
Horrendous. And I know what you're going to answer here, but would there be no sense of pleading with the gods or appealing to their humanity or anything like that?
No, you make a joke, try not to get hit with the stick, go handle your business. I didn't kill anyone, Ben, but I was around murderers. I had to be harder than the murderers.
And you were there on death row and you were innocent and there was other people on death row. Do you think that were in a similar position to you, or was your impression of that death row was by and large filled with very dangerous people who were there for the correct reason?
85% obviously guilty. No problem with that. I'll agree to that. But I got other people off of death row who were innocent, both while I was on death row and after I got out.
Okay, so that's a good place to go back to the story that you just arrived at. You read the article about Colin Pitchfork, and that showed you a new method of proving your innocence when everything else had sort of run dry and gone away. How did you progress that?
I told my lawyer initially I wanted to try for DNA testing, and he was excited about this because it could prove either way if I did it or not. So my very first phone call with him, it was upbeat. A weekend later, or at the end of the conclusion of a weekend, I was put back on the phone with him. And that's when he told me all the evidence from my homicide trial was destroyed and gone. There would be no DNA testing.
What?
When they found out that I was the first guy in America to ask for DNA testing, they tried for the next 15 years to murder me by destroying all the evidence.
What was the official reason given for the evidence being destroyed?
I never got that. I kept finding out that the detective would take some evidence and put it in his desk drawer and leave it there for 3 years, and the court wouldn't answer me. When they found the killer's gloves and more of evidence of the woman's underwear and her clothing, again, no answering. And they drug it out for 15 years while I was then stricken with hepatitis C. So the woman I married and was in love with for 9 years of this ordeal, when I first found out about DNA testing, I had the courage to tell her I was innocent. And I married her in handcuffs. And then over 9 years, she stood by me and helped me with this effort for DNA testing. And then she left me when the evidence broke open and spilled in transit. So after 15 years of trying for DNA evidence and being stricken with an illness, I asked to be executed.
Okay, there's a lot there. Let me just go back a little bit. So you met somebody in prison and got married to them?
Yes.
Can you explain a little bit about that?
The Pennsylvania Prison Society was a group that was trying to have Huntington Prison shut down for its active practices of torture. They came there one day to interview five different prisoners on death row and get their stories before a court about the complaints that they had about the torture that they were enduring. When I was brought out, having already escaped from death row and ruining my appeals, I wasn't like all the other prisoners before me. I had no laments. So I sat before this woman named Jackie and her friend Pamela, and I told them I had no complaints. And they were like, but they're torturing men around you and you're being made to fight and like all these horrible things. And I said, yeah. And for the love of God, I'd love a good cup of coffee. And they were like, how could you be so cavalier about this? This woman was really put off by the fact that I wasn't complaining. But I was sitting there with 105 years plus the death penalty. I was going to die because I made up a story about a murder I didn't know anything about. I put myself on death row with my own stupid mouth. Get it? I didn't have any complaints. I felt like I deserved a lot of the punishment they were giving to me. But it bothered her. And so she came back by herself the next week and the next week and the next week. And she wouldn't hear no. She wanted to know why I wouldn't bother to be upset about where I was. And I told her, I'm in the process of living. I'm not in the process of being here or being here to be executed. I'm trying to live. Mm. As such, I was in the midst, I told her, of reading all the world's religions and as many beautiful books as I can so that by God, I'll have enough poise to speak for myself when they execute me. 6 months after I met her, I found out about DNA testing. It was like a miracle. God gave me someone to love me while I fought for myself. Mm. I didn't know she would leave me.
And you said she would leave you after the evidence broke open in transit. What was that?
I finally got the federal court to help me and provide funding for DNA testing. And when the evidence was shipped out to California from Pennsylvania, it broke open in transit and we lost all the evidence in the box. Jackie, after 9 years of being married to me and loving me, walked into the prison and said, I can't take it no more. Mm. I have to get out of this situation because my mother just died and I'm in a house full of legal boxes and you're never coming home. Mm. So I manned up. I wrote her a beautiful letter and I thanked her for the 9 years that she loved me and I sent her on her way.
Are you still in touch?
No.
Wow. And that must have been crushing for you, the evidence being destroyed.
Yeah, so I decided right then and there I was going to circumnavigate the globe while sitting in my cell in death row. I began writing to pen pals all over the world, and I asked them only one favor. Set my hair free into the oceans, because that's my DNA, and I might not make it out of here. So could you do me a favor? Let me be free. So I sent my hair to New Zealand, Peru, Australia, Europe, everywhere I could find a pen pal. And I asked them, could you do me a favor? Help me circumnavigate the globe while I'm sitting on death row.
And then at the point that the evidence broke open where you thought you'd found an answer to your innocence, how long had that been? How long had you been on death row at that point?
18 years.
Wow, okay, 18 years. So what were the events that led up to your release?
I was stricken with hepatitis C.
Yeah. How do you get hepatitis C?
The dentist didn't change their suction return on his machinery. And after the escape, they beat me for 4 minutes with clubs and they broke my teeth. So he had to do oral surgery to cut my gums and remove the bones. So I got stricken with the same hepatitis C that killed a couple of the other men underneath me.
Wow.
So I had to sit in my cell and listen to them torture the other inmates that died.
Okay, so you've got this illness. I mean, one of the things I wanted to ask is, you know, you'd been sitting on death row now for around 20 years. You know, this country, as you know, doesn't have the death penalty. Why don't they, when they've decided to give the death penalty and that you're guilty of it, why don't they execute you the next week? What's the 20 years?
You have an automatic guaranteed appeal.
I see.
But when there's 250 appeals going on, it takes a long time for the courts to address all of them.
I see.
As well as the non-death penalty cases.
I see. So the time it takes to execute a prisoner is basically the time it takes for them to exhaust the appeal process.
While amongst the backdrop of 1,000 appeals.
Sure. Okay. All right. So you were ill, you had hepatitis, and yeah, please take us forward from there.
I signed up for the treatments. Interferon and ribavirin are the two cancer-fighting drugs, because in the Western world, the philosophy is nearly kill the host and you'll kill a virus within the host. Mm. So they nearly killed me, but they blinded me in my cell, and I felt like that was enough. So when I got my eyesight back after 3 days of being blinded in my cell, I sat down and wrote a letter to the courts and I asked to be executed for something I didn't do.
And why did you, was that just the end of what you could take?
I decided not to be like Dale Carter, who was tortured on his way out of dying from the same illness in the cells underneath me, with the nurses euphemistically asking him would he like some aspirin while he died of the pain of impacted bowel syndrome.
God.
I wasn't going out like that.
So you requested an earlier execution?
I asked that my lawyers be dismissed so that I could be executed. And the federal court stepped in and finally ordered the remaining DNA testing be done.
Based on you asking to be executed? Yes. Why would they do that?
Because a man that's been asking for DNA for 15 years didn't sit right with the judge.
Okay. So that sounds like someone doing the right thing after a lot of people doing the wrong thing.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And what happened?
In February of 2003, the murderer's gloves yielded DNA from the victim and from the murderer and from a possible second female victim. The court then ordered a consumptive test of the remaining evidence. I was brought to this cheap hearing and agreed to it like I wouldn't. And in July of 2003, they got spermatozoa results from the victim's underwear matching the killer's gloves of who unknown male, whoever he is, and then another man's DNA as well, and none of it matched me.
Wow. And was that, at that moment, is that you being free, exonerated?
Being exonerated, but it still took me another 8 months to be let go.
Okay, so they've decided that you definitely are innocent. Why does it take 8 months to be released?
No one wants to let the murderer and the monster go that they feared, who escaped and terrorized them.
Mm.
They literally thought I was going to get out and get a gun and come kill them because of what they did to me. Wasn't my mindset, but that was theirs.
What did it feel like to be told the DNA test had come back and cleared you?
It was it was the most anticlimactic moment of my life.
Wow. Okay. Why?
I had my first lawyer on the phone telling me the results segue into how I was the office joke, how they didn't believe me, and oh my God, I guess you are innocent. Followed by me hanging up the phone from him, calling my mother up, and trying excitedly tell her the news, only to be told, that's wonderful, but your brother Mikey's having a seizure at my feet, and I can't even handle that right now. I'm so happy you're going to get your life back, Nikki, but Mikey's laying on the ground here, and I got to put something in his mouth so he doesn't choke to death.
Wow, okay. It's pretty heavy. Well, how did you feel?
Cried my eyes out.
Mm.
Look at the damage I did to my family. Look at the damage I did to my life.
The damage you did to your family?
Oh, yeah. I put myself on death row by being a junkie, thief, and a liar. I put myself on death row. They just helped to put me there as well.
Mm.
I never once want anybody to think I'm not responsible for what I did to myself. I made up a lie about this poor victim. May I never forget that. And I cried because I ruined my life, not because they did anything to me. I let my parents suffer. My little brother died of a drug overdose in my basement. I'd never be proud about that.
Mm. Okay, so it takes 8 months, but what's the time leading up to your release? What does that look like? Do they tell you there's a date you're going to be released on, or, you know, there's a conversation ongoing?
I swear to God, Ben, they botched my release, man.
Okay.
8 o'clock in the morning, they put me in a van with all my little letters and stuff. I say goodbye to the administration. It's my moment.
Mm.
They drive me across this big prison called Greene County Supermax. We get up to the first gate. Oh, man, I can see my parents. They're outside with the press. Literally 50 yards away from me. I get up to the last gate and they say, he ain't going home. Paperwork in Florida's not done. So they actually had the prison officer so incensed by this, he refused to turn the vehicle around. He backed the vehicle up across the whole compound of the prison. He said, I'm not turning around. So we backed up, and the administration surrounded the van and started pleading with me to understand that it wasn't them playing a game on me or a joke on me, that this was just a procedural problem for the state of Florida. And that right at that moment, a lawyer named Elliot Shirker had put a lawyer on a flight to Tallahassee, Florida, the state capital, to try and get my paperwork right at that moment stamped and completed so I could be released.
And how long did that take then, that process?
Hours.
So you were sitting in the van for hours?
I was sitting in a building, not in a cell, because they asked me, what could they do for me? I said, look, I just spent 8,057 days on death row. Yeah. We're in a cell. Whatever you do, don't put me back in a cell because I can't promise not to hurt you.
Okay, so talk us through being actually when it all gets stamped and it all gets done. What does release feel like after all this time?
I walked up to the microphones out front. They didn't put me back in a van. They walked me out the front doors. I walked up to the assembled press and I told them about my two friends that were innocent in the prison behind me, and I walked off. I didn't complain. I didn't lament. I had no time for this. I knew what I was going to do, Ben. I was going to be next level me.
And what's next level you?
I was going to make all of this mean something. I wasn't going to let what they did to me mean nothing. Mm. So right there on the spot, I decided to use my education. I started an economic embargo against Pennsylvania by going to five of its biggest trade partners in Europe and here in the United Kingdom. This is what led me to become a UK citizen. I came here to address a combined session of the lower house of parliament only 10 months after that day when I got released. Imagine you have this wonderful world-class education where you know you can effectuate change and you've been given a beautiful voice practicing for your own death. Mm. I knew I could do this. So much so that I went on in just months after my release to have some of the biggest platforms ever of speaking, including the Colosseum in Rome and other places.
And did the US ever admit wrongdoing? Did you receive any compensation?
I had to file a lawsuit against Pennsylvania, but no one's going to ever bear responsibility like that and come forward and apologize. Mm. You're never going to get resolution, and any money that they're going to give you is going to be pity money.
Of course, yeah.
So I decided when I first came here, I went to Hyde Park, Speaker's Corner, and I began practice my speaking. That's where it all began. Mm. I had no bank account, no home, other than the one that was being given to me by the woman I had met who brought me here. And I began my whole career believing in myself by standing in the park, practicing my speaking beautifully.
And you've mentioned God a lot during this conversation. Are you quite a religious person then?
I am not, but I'm a spiritual person.
Okay.
You know the difference.
Please tell me.
Religiosity is adherence to the religion, whereas I believe in God itself, and its energy form is in many forms. That's why I made the endeavor to read all of the world's religions so I could respect you if you're Hindu, Muslim, or whatever. Hmm. I believe that God is good. That if you read any one of the world's religions, invariably, it's an instruction course of being a good human. Mm. For the reward might be in the afterlife or this life, but still, it's still an instruction on what? Being good.
Your life has been incredible, so unique. When you look back on it, what do you think it's taught you?
Upon looking back and reflecting upon everything, the answer truly is love. If you can develop kindness, and I mean real kindness, for yourself and others, you can become the most incredibly strong human being you ever imagined about yourself. I used to think that anger was the way to keep me alive and that my fist and my fury were my way of answering any challenge. Then I found out how powerful I could become by being a kind person, kind enough to myself to respect me, kind enough to, in life to help others. That's such an empowering thing. I know I'm one of the baddest men on the planet. I am the finest speaker alive. And I believe in myself so much because I learned to love this person that I am. I wrote a book called The Kindness Approach. And basically, I have lightning in a bottle. I can get that person, whoever it is, to actually come back. Time and again, people with destroyed lives have trusted me and they've healed. And if I think about that, isn't there any bigger, more beautiful gift you can be given than that alone? I'm living one of the greatest stories of all time. I get that. But I'm also living it with kindness.
Look, I mean, earlier on in the conversation, you said that you wanted to become a great speaker. And it's actually really hard to imagine you not being a great speaker, because genuinely I've sat here for the last hour and a half just absolutely entranced by not only your story, but your unbelievable way of telling it. You are a fantastic speaker. And I just want to say thank you so much for coming here and being so open and sharing such an incredible story.
Thank you, Ben. I want you to know something. Every time I speak, I have this one notion. There's a person who's going to hear this, who's had the most tragic things. But listening to me, they know it's all a lie and they're going to come to me. I'll show you by message. You'll see. I've had so many incidents like this. My blessing will come from the person who needs this moment to be real. For that, I'll always pour my heart out over and over because I know that's my purpose now. I can't believe I got a chance to sit down and address so many people on the Blad Bible platform. For those of you who don't know this, I came back to England recently because I'm in love with this country. So I don't care if you're from Scotland, Wales, Ireland, or wherever. Thank you for being family to me. I thank you for listening to me today because we only get this one chance. May it be beautiful. May it be something important for you.
Understood. Nick, thanks so much for being here. It was a pleasure to meet you.
And the same, Ben. Thank you, everyone. And I look forward to you finding me on Instagram or wherever. And I hope that I can come back in the future and show that this is real.
Of course. I look forward to it.
Definitely. Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.